Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. And in hour two of today's show, we're returning to the subject of 9/11. We talk a lot about 9/11 on this show. In many ways, 9/11 was the trigger for the creation of this show and probably many alternative media sources, people who began looking at that event and began investigating it and found that the mainstream media was doing such a shabby job of covering it that many people were forced into citizen journalism simply in order to address the unresolved questions that are so obvious. As soon as you actually start to look at it with a critical eye, you just find there are all these unexplained things, all these anomalies, all these questions about motive, and you look at the people who are actually accused of doing it, and you see, well, none of them has ever gone to trial. And look at the people who's actually got the motive for it. Well, they're actually the ones who supposedly were the victim, being, of course, the United States government and the military-industrial complex, which wanted to embark on a military campaign as documented in their policy documents, such as the Project for a New American Century. And we've got, the supposed ringleader of the 9/11 events, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, still having not gone to trial after being held in Guantanamo Bay in solitary confinement and conditions amounting to torture for years, and still, I believe, now finally moving into trial, but within the confines of a military court, which, of course, remove all of the protections that we normally have in the legal system. Evidence obtained under torture, for example, is admissible in the military court. So, I mean, the questions and the cloud of controversy over 9/11 is just, it's immense. And yet, whenever you try to bring up this subject in the company of people who get their new information from the mainstream news, you're generally met with immediate derision. And any suggestion that 9/11 was not according to the official narrative is treated as some kind of wacko conspiracy theory. When in fact, you might just be asking certain questions about, the unusual stock trades, the hunt for Osama bin Laden didn't seem to be very well focused. Where was the body of bin Laden? Why did they dump it at sea? I mean, any questions like that are immediately lumped in with the sort of wacko, gee, you must be a wacko. And of course, that is a meme. That is actually what I believe is a deliberate construct created by the propagandists who are essentially the media, who support the military-industrial complex and the corrupt regimes that are now embarked in a plan of global domination. And the information war, the propaganda war, is central to their war. Now, those of us who have been researching 9/11 and have been looking for truth have decided we are now going to try and dig up facts, and we're going to be very careful and we're going to be very selective, because we want to actually bring forth incontrovertible facts which are not speculation, are not mere spin or gossip, contrary to actually what the mainstream media does. We in the truth movement are offering facts, and we only need a few of them in order to completely demolish the web of lies that's been woven around these events. Now, that's what the majority, I would say the majority of people that I've met who are 9/11 truthers think we need to do. And indeed, the word truth has a ring about it that is actually has its significance, in the sense that you're trying to say, well, here is fact. This is fact, and we adhere to fact in what we are trying to say. Now, having said that, there are people out there who are part of the broader 9/11 truth movement who actually don't 100% subscribe to what I've just said. And one such person, I believe, and we'll probably get into debating that in this discussion, one such person is Joshua Blakeney. And I would just like to give you a brief introduction to Joshua Blakeney, who's on the line as we speak. Joshua Blakeney is a journalist and activist originally from Surrey, UK, living in Calgary, Alberta. Joshua was the media coordinator of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge from September 2009 to October 2010. Joshua earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in sociology from the University of Lethbridge, and he is currently studying for a Master of Arts degree at the University of Lethbridge. And he was awarded the Queen Elizabeth II Graduate Scholarship to study the origins of the global war on terror. And Joshua, just like to say welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Yes, I'm one of those 9/11 truthers who's funded by the British monarchy, it would appear.
Well, that's something that I'd like to get into as well, but we'll leave that maybe for later. But look, Josh, in my introduction there, what I'm trying to point out is you were a co-organizer of this event, the 9/11 Vancouver hearings, which has as its moniker opening the boundaries or expanding the boundaries of 9/11 truth. And you've actually attracted, with your co-organizer, Jim Fetzer, some of the most, fringe elements of the 9/11 truth movement who basically do not follow the principle that I outlined before, which is let's focus in on what we can really know and what we can really present as fact so that we can puncture the wall of propaganda. Whereas your team seems to be like saying, let's just get out there and get any ideas, as controversial as they may be, and let's just throw them all in and see what we get. Is that correct? Am I representing that correctly?
Yes, in a way, it's a fair characterization. My mentor, Professor Anthony Hawes, compared it to the early gay rights movement, where there was one faction that sought to put on suits and act kind of straight and act in a representable and a prim and proper way. And then there were the kind of drag queens. And so some have said that our conference was the latter faction translated into the 9/11 truth movement. Now, there are two divergent philosophies, I would say, in the 9/11 truth movement. One of those philosophies was embraced at the Toronto hearings, which took place on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, September 11th, roughly 2011. And I went to Toronto and attended those events. And that philosophy holds that if we advance the most incontrovertible pieces of evidence, act in a representable way, act in a respectable and a smart and sophisticated way, we will persuade the journalists to report the truth about 9/11. The government will have no choice other than to investigate 9/11 because we would have created an intellectual environment conducive to the people demanding such an investigation. And I think in the aftermath of 9/11, in the first couple of years, as people came to realize that obviously the official story of 9/11 is false, I think that approach had some justification. The kind of Richard Gage approach where, I had a chance to spend 3 days with Richard recently when he toured Canada, and he always introduces himself as being something different to so-called conspiracy theorists. He says, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I just have facts. Approach is acceptable, in a kind of conservative way. But I would say that, we're a decade on now. And I was sort of talking to Richard Gage about this when I was with him. And I was saying, are you just going to walk around for another decade talking about Building 7? Meanwhile, the scoundrels who did 9/11 are getting away scot-free because no one's actually trying to deal with the political implications of the 9/11 science. There's been a kind of real overemphasis on technical aspects of 9/11 and a corresponding atrophy when it comes to dealing with the kind of whodunit questions. And I think one reason that is, and I got into this because I happen to have a background in pro-Palestinian activism. I think one reason is that you get kind of do-gooders who come into 9/11 truth with good intentions. And as soon as you scratch beneath the surface, you realize that many roads lead back to Tel Aviv. Many Israeli fingerprints or handprints are on the 9/11 crimes. And so I think a lot of people allow themselves to become absorbed with, minute and narrow technical questions when it comes to 9/11, because they actually realize it's highly politically incorrect when you get into questions like who are the neocons, what motivated them, who benefited the most from 9/11, and so on. Now, and in my case, I found myself becoming a little frustrated with that faction who used to, you know, email me and say things like, you're hurting the truth movement if you bring up, for example, the Israelis who were arrested on 9/11, or even suggest that Israel may have been one of the prime motivators behind 9/11, one of the culprits, the 9/11 criminals, were perhaps serving Israeli state interests. I got told, you know, I'm hurting the truth movement, as if our goal was merely to try and advance the image of the truth movement, or advance the image of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, for example, rather than to try and indict those criminals who murdered 3,000 people on 9/11 and have murdered millions of people subsequently. And so I went to the Toronto hearings and reflected upon it with a colleague of mine, someone who I like a great deal, Professor James Fetzer,
right.
You know, at the limitations of the Toronto hearings, because they took this conservative approach where, you know, there was going to be, in fact, one of the tenets that they stated on their website for selecting evidence, one of the principles was that it ought to be the least controversial evidence that would be advanced at their hearings. Well, that in and of itself is a kind of controversial stance to take, because uncontroversial evidence can be trivial and less apposite, and controversial evidence can, of course, be more pertinent. And so, you know, saying that because a piece of evidence might be politically incorrect or controversial, that justifies it being suppressed is itself, you know, controversial to say. And so reflecting upon the limitations of the Toronto hearings, the fact that it didn't get into the whodunit, really, it kind of presupposed that, you know, 9/11 was primarily advancing the interests of the American empire, whereas there's a whole school of thought now that has emerged in the scholarship in the pro-Palestinian movement, which has demonstrated, you know, by scholars like Walton Mearsheimer, James Petras, Virginia Tilley, Stephen Snegoski, and so on, who have demonstrated that to a large extent the neocons were representing the state interests of Israel, that they actually allowed the American empire to deviate from its traditional Cold War policy of trying to foment stability for oil markets, where the 9/11 wars have facilitated to a large extent the destabilization of the Middle East. So these questions to do with geopolitics, which leads us into the kind of whodunit questions, and of course leads us often into Tel Aviv, were largely marginalized by the Toronto hearings and by many 9/11 truthers. And so rather than, you know, sit and fulminate against those people, who many of whom are sincere academicians who organized the Toronto hearings, Professor Fetzer and I and some colleagues decided to do our own conference in Vancouver in order to expand the boundaries of 9/11 truth, in order to address the most controversial elements within the 9/11 truth movement, premised on the notion that unless we confront controversy and confront the disputed facets of 9/11, we'll never resolve our disputes, because there is a kind of, I think there's an approach in the 9/11 truth movement to kind of act like a bad marriage, where in private on our fora and on, you know, in private company, we can have vibrant arguments, you know, in email exchanges and so on. We can argue, you know, how did the towers really come down? Because obviously nanothermite only provides a partial picture of how the towers were felled. Were Israel involved? Was Israel involved? To what extent?
Joshua, we're just heading to break.
Israeli state interests and so on.
We're just heading to break. Sorry, Joshua, to interrupt. We're just heading to break. We're just heading to break shortly. Now, I would like to return to that question about Israel, because I know you've got a very hard position on that, and I'd actually like to focus in on the question of the definition of what is controversial and what that actually means when we get back from the break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. I'm interviewing Joshua Blakeney, co-organiser of the Vancouver 9/11 hearings. We'll be right back. Please stay with us. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
You win a while.
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm Heroid Fenton. Today I'm talking to Joshua Blakeney about 9/11 Truth and the boundaries of that, which Josh has been working to expand in the bringing together of some very controversial figures in the 9/11 Truth movement, such as Jim Fetzer and other people. And I'd like to actually get a run-through of the key figures there at the conference, Joshua. But one thing I'd just like to point out is that you mentioned a point that I actually agree with, which is that we should not shy away from any topic simply because it is controversial. Now, if that was actually the way the Toronto hearings framed their criteria, I would disagree with that. I don't think that's appropriate. My understanding, and this is having talked to people like David Chandler and Frank Legg and people like that who are the more conservative voices in the research movement who publish at the Journal of 9/11 Studies, it's not that they want to avoid controversy. It's that they want to have an evidence-based approach. Now, what I would like to find out from you, Joshua, is whether you agree with having an evidence-based approach is the correct way to move forward. Because, you see, controversy will always be there. Now, some views are more controversial simply because they push more buttons in people and offend more people. Now, that should never be a reason not to talk about it, and I totally agree with that. But there is perhaps another context in which that may have been the way it was being used when they talked at Toronto, is that they simply wanted to advance the evidence-based views, which were, because they were evidence-based, less controversial. So not so much the controversy being the key point here, is that whether they are evidence-based. And that, to me, is an absolute essential if you want to actually not even just be understood or be respected. If you want to really find out what happened, the scientific method is the way forward. And the scientific method is an evidence-based approach. So, I mean, can I just get your opinion on that?
Well, the first principle of the scientific method is actually speculation, where you should come up with hypotheses and then test those hypotheses to see if they correspond with the available evidence. Now, there's been an attempt in the 9/11 Truth Movement to say, oh, that hypothesis sounds outlandish, or you've now come up with a hypothesis that I disagree with, and now we're going to ostracize you and marginalize you. And so actually, if we're sticking to the scientific method, the first step is to actually accept conflicting hypotheses before we get to the evidence. And of course, I would support an evidence-based approach. But, you know, I've sat through many court trials. For example, one of my friends attempted a citizen's arrest on George Bush when he came here to Calgary, and I sat through multiple-day court trial. And actually, I think the main emphasis and the main word we should be invoking is relevancy, not evidence. Obviously, all of our arguments have to ultimately boil down to, is there evidence to support them? I understand that. But yeah. I think relevancy is what we have to address. And I think that at the Toronto hearings, in their attempt to appeal to the bigots in the mainstream media, in their attempt to avoid controversy, they allowed themselves to bring speakers in who address subjects that lacked relevancy to 9/11. For example, there's a lady who I've participated in speaking engagements with named Laurie Manuel, a very nice young lady, you know, who's doing a PhD in psychology. But she spoke about something that had nothing to do with 9/11 at the Toronto hearings. It was to do with what part of the brain makes us defer to authority and how people may or may not accept theories. And in fact, her whole thesis was we should actually speak in an indirect way when it comes to forwarding controversial arguments. And so I think that the word relevancy is what we should be debating. And I think that what I tried to do anyway when it comes to the politics, I mean, you could say certain speakers at the Vancouver hearings are controversial if that's your perspective, but I address the politics of 9/11, and I think that there has been many assumptions which are not supported by the evidence when it comes to who were the main, who gained the most from 9/11, and what were the main motivations for the 9/11 crime. And so, again, I think another thing we have to address is what is the goal of the 9/11 Truth Movement 10 years on from 9/11, and perhaps that question should be put to Frank Legg and Mr. Chandler. You know, I mean, what is the goal? I mean, this idea that if we just act in a certain way and portray ourselves in a kind of respectable manner, that one day the government will investigate or one day the media will report fairly about 9/11. I mean, I think that's a bankrupt approach to 9/11 activism. I think that the government investigating itself would be the equivalent of a surgeon operating on his own foot. It's not going to happen. the political class are so heavily implicated in the crimes of the post 9/11 world that they're never going to investigate. And therefore, we, the citizens, have to do a robust and holistic citizens investigation into 9/11, which requires us not to take this kind of public relations, Richard Gage style approach to 9/11 activism, where we're trying to promote our image and our brand as if we're some kind of corporation or cult, but rather to actually, in a forthright manner, come together in public fora to debate the conflicting hypotheses with the hope of resolving our conflict, as a court would do. If you go into a court, there is a prosecution and there's a defendant, and the judge entertains the conflicting arguments. And usually when you have conflicting hypotheses and test them against the evidence, you then deduce the truth at the end of that process. And I think that there's been an attempt by people in the truth movement, maybe they're imposters for all we know. Certain elements obviously realize that the genie was out the bottle when everyone saw images like Building 7. And I think there was an attempt to contain the 9/11 truth movement. So rather than just outright kind of banning the 9/11 truth movement, saying you're all to be locked up like a totalitarian society would do, there was infiltrators in the truth movement who sought to contain the truth movement by coming up with phrases like you're hurting the movement and so on. And that approach is all predicated on the idea that if we just act in a certain way, if we speak in a certain manner, if we exclude certain controversial pieces of evidence, then the government will have no choice other than to investigate. But in my opinion, that's a bankrupt approach. And so that's why you saw the kind of more rough and tumble approach at the Vancouver hearings.
Can we just run through, Joshua, the actual content of the hearings, just for our audience who might not be that familiar with it? Obviously, the co-organizer was Professor Jim Fetzer. I mean, maybe we could start there. And if you could just give us a summary of what you consider to be the key some of the key figures in the conference, that would be great.
Well, we obviously one issue at the Toronto hearings was they didn't want to address the Pentagon.
Right.
I guess there's a dispute. I mean, I would say probably 90% of the truth movement has concluded that no plane hit the Pentagon, but for some reason that was deemed controversial. And so we wanted to confront the Pentagon in a forthright manner. So we had Enver Massoud who came, Barbara Honegger, and Dean Hartwell came and spoke on the first evening about the Pentagon. It was very interesting. Also, Professor Fetzer made reference to the Pentagon in his presentation. How the Twin Towers were destroyed was addressed, because, of course, unfortunately, there's been a myth that's been allowed to coagulate in the truth movement that nanothermite explained how the towers were felled. That the nanothermite is a high explosive that created the observed effects, but that's not actually true. Nanothermite has very limited properties, explosive properties, and therefore, 10 years on, we don't actually know how the towers were brought down. So there's some people who are really concerned with that, who would like to find out how the towers came down. Obviously, there's conflicting hypotheses about that. And again, we could dismiss hypotheses because they sound outlandish to us, such as, you know, things like directed energy weapons and so on. Or we could actually allow those people to try and come up and, you know, stand up in front of an audience and make that case for there being the use, for example, of unknown weaponry or other things on 9/11. And if that's compelling, I'm sure that people will be persuaded by that. And if it's not compelling, I'm sure they'll reject that hypothesis. But we weren't taking the kind of approach of having a, you know, a priori dismissal of people's perspectives if they're committed 9/11 truthers. So we addressed how did the towers come down? Were mini nukes involved and so on? But a lot of people in the truth movement are interested in those questions. And I think that that's because, you know, there is some evidence to suggest that, you know, something, some kind of unknown technology was used beyond nanothermite on 9/11. So that we allowed that discussion to take place.
Now, is it true, Joshua, that Professor Fetzer believes that the Twin Towers were not actually struck by planes, that he actually now advances the video fakery theory of the attack on the Twin Towers? Is that correct?
Well, I think you have to make the correct distinctions here. To say that at least one video was disseminated on 9/11 to convey a false impression.
Right. We are just heading to break again. I'll get you to pick up on that after the break. I think it's an extremely important one because, of course, the no-planers have really... That particular sect of the 9/11 truth has really been one of the most problematic and controversial. So let's get back into that straight after the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia.
A the man who stole the water will swim forevermore, but he'll never reach the land on that golden shore. That faint white light will haunt his heart till his only memory lost in the dark. Dig a hole in the ground.
Welcome back. I'm with Joshua Blakeney. We're talking about expanding the boundaries of 9/11 truth. We're talking about the Vancouver 9/11 hearings, and we're talking about Professor Jim Fetzer. Now, there are many sub-themes within the, I guess what you would call the alternate views of 9/11, which are not the mainstream views of 9/11 truth. I mean, it starts to get very convoluted even talking about this, because of course 9/11 truth is itself a fringe element of our society, but we're really talking here about the fringe of the fringe. And within that, there are some things that are more or less controversial. The Pentagon question, because there are a number of 9/11 researchers who have now stated that they think quite likely a plane did hit the Pentagon, the question of what hit the Pentagon has become controversial within 9/11 truth. I mean, of course, it's controversial in the bigger picture as well, because the mainstream simply says, well, a plane hit the Pentagon, you know, get over it, okay? Whereas 9/11 truth, for a long time, predominantly, and from the beginning, one of the original questions was what hit the Pentagon, because there wasn't a lot of evidence for something like a large plane having hit there. And you know, it seems legitimate to ask that question, and I totally respect asking that question based on the lack of evidence that a plane hit it, based on the lack of video evidence. But I really just want to focus on right now on the Twin Towers, because this is a far more controversial position within the controversies of 9/11, because a certain group of people have been putting forth very vociferously since early on, you know, since probably about 2003, 2004, I think there was an Australian by the name of Holmgren who first put this idea forwards, that there were no planes at the World Trade Center, that it was done with video fakery, and that the broadcasts that we saw of planes hitting the towers were CGI animations. And they even said, you know, the cutout of the plane in the building was like faked. You know, they actually planted explosives there to make it look like a plane hit. Now, of course, we've got many, many video streams of that event, many, many witnesses. Some of the witnesses are actually, known or are part of the, you know, movement towards 9/11 truth. So the assertion that there were no planes that hit the towers is extremely, extremely controversial. And I just want to get a feel from you, Joshua, and what is your opinion about this position? And then we'll talk about Jim Fetzer.
Yeah, I think we have to be careful not to make straw man arguments in a way that people who dislike the 9/11 truth movement, you know, make about us. And, you know, I think that I personally was interested and compelled when I heard people talking about this, because one argument you often hear by those who challenge the 9/11 truth movement, they say, you know, oh, it would have been too hard to pull off such an elaborate and vast plot, you know. And I thought, well, you know, if there was no planes, that would make it a hell of a lot easier in many ways. And so I actually, you know, I had gone along, you know, I had been a bit of a sheep and gone along with the ostracism against Professor Jim Fetzer. And I eventually took the time, seeing as I was doing my graduate studies on 9/11 and seeing as he is a prominent academic who's written 29 books in his life on a number of subjects. I've read many of them now. I took the time to actually go through his work, watch his lectures and so on. And I concluded that I think that he's a serious academic who has been marginalized and ostracized, I think, for political reasons, because he addresses controversial elements of 9/11, which actually leads us closer to the truth often. And I think that there are many distortions of his positions on things, where he says, I think it's possible that people will then translate that into Jim Fetzer said it's probable that, and so on. In the case of the towers, I believe Professor Fetzer's position is that flying somethings hit the tower. So he doesn't deny that some flying projectiles struck the Twin Towers on 9/11.
Right. Okay, well, that's good to know that. Okay.
protecting the Twin Towers. He also holds that some of the videos must be fake because they portray impossible events. For example, a building offering no more resistance to a plane than air, which is, you know, scientifically impossible. Now, I think it wouldn't be outlandish to say if the government can blow up World Trade Center Building 7, that the government can also, on 9/11, disseminate at least one video to convey a false impression. That's how Professor Fetzer defines video fakery: any video that was disseminated to convey a false impression. And I think that many in the truth movement, even if we're talking about the Pentagon, would conclude that the government did indeed, you know, disseminate some videos on 9/11 to convey a false impression. And so when people say, "Oh, are you with those video fakery people?" If you actually stop and think about it, it's not that outlandish to suggest that a video or two may have been disseminated to aid and abet those 9/11 criminals. And likewise, Professor Fetzer's position that flying somethings hit the Twin Towers, but they weren't, you know, Boeing 767s, is also, I think, a legitimate position to take, especially now you have pilots for 9/11 Truth coming up with evidence that Flight 11 and Flight 77 weren't even scheduled on 9/11, and so on. And so I think that there's been an exaggeration, a deliberate distortion of Professor Fetzer's positions on these matters, because actually he is often leading us closer to the truth, which is bad for the 9/11 criminals and for the saboteurs in the 9/11 truth movement who are seeking tirelessly to contain the 9/11 truth movement and prevent us from basically getting to the truth and indicting the 9/11 criminals. What we did at the Vancouver hearings was we had jurists come and hear the evidence that we brought forth. We were sworn in with, you know, when we give our testimony. And what we're doing now is actually getting a lot closer to the 9/11 truth, to 9/11 truth, in order to indict the criminals who did 9/11. And I think that the kind of public relations approach of the 9/11 truth movement, it was a nice attempt in the aftermath of 9/11. But to be honest, it failed. The government's not investigated 9/11, and I'm not surprised that they didn't. And now we, the citizens, are doing our own investigation. And if we were in a real court of law, the first thing the judge and the prosecution would say is, sorry, talking about certain elements of 9/11 is irrelevant. We have to talk about the relevant, you know, in a court of law, you can't indict an explosive. You have to indict a human being. And I'm trying to lead us closer to who did 9/11 and how did they do it. And that's why I was compelled by the idea that it may not have been passenger jets that struck the Twin Towers, because I think that would make the 9/11 plot easier to have pulled off.
And now, can I just point out, just to, you know, counterbalance what you're saying, the video of the second impact of Tower 2, right, was carried live by at least three different live television networks, which had their cameras trained on the building, because of course the first plane hit at about 8:45. The second plane hit it a little after 9. At that point, there were the entire media had converged on the Twin Towers. So if what Jim Fetzer is saying is true, then that live footage must have been edited in some way. Is that what you're actually saying? That live streaming footage of that second plane, which we all saw on television, if we had the television on, was somehow faked live?
No, I'm actually saying that if you want to debate this, you have to have Professor Jim Fetzer on your show. And I don't know if you're one of those people who may have gone along with the, you know, Chinese whispers in relation to Professor Fetzer and gone along with the kind of rumors about him. But if you want to debate this, you're welcome to have him on your show. I'm not claiming or purporting to be an expert on this subject. I just found it compelling and was happy to hear him out, because I've heard him out. I've discussed this matter with him many times, and I find many elements of his arguments, very compelling. I'm not going to get into defending this or that position, because I'm not someone who's done primary research on this subject. Professor Fetzer is one of the protagonists of this school of thought, and so you're welcome to talk to him about it. But I myself, Joshua Blakeney, a graduate student at the University of Lethbridge, has focused on the political dimension of 9/11. I've focused on, because I have a background in Israel-Palestine, in the Israel-Palestine subject, I focused on that in my activism. And I realized quite quickly as I got into 9/11 studies that Israel was heavily implicated in 9/11, and that this could be the key to solving the Israel-Palestine conflict, because, of course, endlessly, pro-Palestinian groups are bringing speakers onto campuses to talk about the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. And that has a limited resonance with middle-class white North Americans. But I would say if you could tell North Americans that they, too, were also victims of Zionist terrorism on 9/11, they were victims of Israeli foreign policy on 9/11, that might have enough resonance to compel North American citizens to pressure their governments to change their one-sided approach to the Israel-Palestine conflict, take a more nuanced position, and, for example, in the case of the United States, stop offering Israel impunity every time it violates international law and seeks to murder the Palestinians. And so I myself, in my studies, have focused on the political dimension. I've engaged in the vibrant debate that's gone on to do with is the Zionist tail wagging the American dog? Obviously, we all know that Israel's fingerprints are on the 9/11 incident. And so I personally have challenged those who have, kind of taken a cookie cutter from the Cold War of trying to blame everything on the CIA and the American Empire and the military-industrial complex, and rather tried to deconstruct who the neocons were, what motivated them, what actually transpired in the Middle East after 9/11. I think, you know, there were many cliches and a great deal of mantra when it came to, oh, it was a war for oil and so on. But increasingly in the scholarship, there's been a challenge to that theory that the Iraq War, for example, was first and foremost a war for oil. For example, James Petras, a sociologist whose works were...
We're just going to break again. Joshua, we would like to get back into that. I'd actually like to get more into your views on Israel. I know that was a main part of your presentation at the conference. So in the final segment here this hour, we'll be talking a bit about that, and we'll be right back with Truth News Radio Australia. With Truth News Radio Australia, broadcasting out of Sydney, Australia, and our website is www.truthnews.com.au. Please drop by and visit us sometime. You can join our mailing list and get our podcast mailed to you every week. And of course, you can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes and other podcast distribution media. And you can also join our Facebook group. There's quite a lot of interesting discussion on there. And if you happen to be listening to this in the US and you're interested in Australian news, I would highly recommend it. But of course, we get into everything that affects the world too. And 9/11 being one of those events that changed the world is, you know, right in our sights. And exploring it, explaining it, looking at all the controversies and all the questions is part of our mission. Now, I've got Joshua Blakeney on, who's been talking about the more controversial aspects and theorists within the 9/11 truth movement. And we were talking there about Jim Fetzer. And I'd actually like to just point out a bit more controversy here, Joshua. One of your judges, according to the website, a judge, as you said earlier, you had jurists, you know, within the conference there to assess the evidence. Now, one of these is Alfred Labremont Webre, who is the webmaster of a site called exopolitics.com. And among other many, many bizarre claims of doctor or professor, I'm not sure whether he's a professor, but I know he's a doctor of law, I believe. What he proposes is that Barack Obama was teleported to Mars by the CIA. Now, I just really have to put that out there because it is one of the most bizarre and, on the face of it, ludicrous things I think I've ever heard. And this was one of your key people who was appointed as a judge at the conference. So Barack Obama was teleported to Mars by the CIA. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, well, when deciding to which jurist to choose, people did mention that Alfred Weber, in other contexts, in subjects other than 9/11 studies, he's got some controversial opinions. But then when I was told of his credentials, he's an international jurist, went to Yale Law School. He was on the Kuala Lumpur Tribunal, that, you know, one of the jurists involved in the Kuala Lumpur Tribunal that recently indicted George Bush and Dick Cheney. I had to weigh up the pros and cons. So I have people telling me, you know, I haven't really looked into that, to be honest, because it's not really that relevant to 9/11. But, you know, that he has some theories, you know, that are more on the fringes, you might say, that, you know, obviously quite astonishing to some people, and to me too, frankly. If I didn't actually get the, I wanted to talk to him about his opinions on this, you know, over a beer or something after the conference. But
I think you'd need several large schooners in order to get into that topic properly.
I think so, but you know. When I, you know, obviously I'm quite a busy chap. You know, I'm a journalist for Press TV now too. I'm doing graduate studies. I'm very busy. But when I saw that he was involved, he was one of the main jurists, actually, I believe, on the Kuala Lumpur Tribunal. And people who I trusted, people whose opinion I trusted, such as Dr. Kevin Barrett, you know, they said, look, I've had him on my show. And yes, I disagree with him on this or that point. But at the end of the day, he's a very cogent and articulate spokesperson for social justice causes. I said, well, you know, let's back him and say, look, come along. We're talking only about 9/11. We're having an evidence-based approach. We're trying to resolve the disputes in the 9/11 truth movement. And I must say, he was more than pleasing. He was actually one of the main someone in the whole conference, the person who took indicting the 9/11 criminals the most seriously was Alfred Weber. You know, he stood up at the end and gave a marvelous, judicious appraisal of the evidence. He subsequently sent out many emails to all of those of us who testified at the Vancouver hearings, you know, helping to provide categories for the different pieces of evidence. And he's really, really gung-ho for pursuing this, these, you know, kind of judicial, quasi-judicial approach, criminal investigations into who did 9/11. And so, yeah, you could say, like, you can say that, you know, maybe on other subjects he's controversial. I mean, there's other people there who participated, I think, who, for example, have done work within the subjects of what did not happen in World War II, which, okay, again, is controversial. But we're talking about 9/11. We're not talking about the Holocaust. We're not talking about UFOs, we're not talking about those subjects. And so you have to, you know, you have to make, if we're talking about 9/11, you have to take the arguments that people have made vis-a-vis 9/11 and decide whether those are relevant or, you know, irrelevant to what happened on 9/11. And so the people we included, it was based on an appraisal of their work for social justice, their work in terms of trying to indict war criminals. And first and foremost, it was to do with what they have and have not said on 9/11. And
well,
so,
he's,
you know,
he's obviously an incredibly interesting guy, and probably requires an entire show just to engage with some of that stuff. Let's, in the time we've got left, Joshua, let's get your take on Israel and 9/11, because we don't have a lot of time left. I'd like to know, because I know you gave a presentation at the conference on this subject. Can you just hit us with it? What's your view on the connection of Israel and 9/11?
Well, I called my paper The Likudnik Origins of the War on Terror. And so I wasn't actually per se dealing with what did or did not transpire on 9/11, actually. I was more trying to provide what I believe to be the correct historical context for understanding 9/11. And there was one approach to 9/11 studies which emerged in the media aftermath of 9/11, a thesis offered, for example, by Professor Chosudovsky, Webster Tarpley, and others, where you kind of list all the false flag attacks that the U.S. government has been implicated in, and then you portray 9/11 as having been a kind of extension of the U.S. Cold War policy, the American Empire. But increasingly, there's a body of scholarship that's emerged that has identified the fact that the post-9/11 foreign policy of the United States deviated markedly from the traditional foreign policy of what might be called the traditional foreign policy establishment in the United States, and that, in fact, a new faction, a nouveau riche faction, kind of ousted the kind of incumbent power structure, the ousted those who were in power, basically in the foreign policy establishment, which includes people like Brzezinski, and supplanted them with their kind of new strategies for kind of doing social engineering in the Middle East, reordering the Middle East ensemble. And I argue that actually this has a lot more to do with the imperatives, the geopolitical imperatives of Israel. And if you actually look at, like, the Likud party, look at Likud-affiliated think tanks and so on, you see in the 1980s and 1990s that they were calling for the kinds of things that actually transpired in the aftermath of 9/11. Then you look at who the neocons were, you know, the preponderance of whom were Zionist Jews, people who had a history of promoting Israel's interests. You take, for example, Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Veit. Both of those guys lost their security clearances in the 1980s. passing classified documents to Israel, and you get a very different picture. And then you can, just as people list the US's false flag attacks or attempts like Operation Northwoods, you could also list Israel's false flag attacks. And so arguing from history in that regard, you know, it doesn't tell us everything. And so I believe that, you know, when it comes to 9/11, the best context, you know, I think basically to understand the history of the history leading up to 9/11, we have to look at Israel. We have to look at the disputes that arose within the US ruling class. You know, there's a faction in the ruling class that basically puts Israel's interests first over what might be conceived of as the US national interest. And I think this manifested itself, for example, in the Gulf War number one, where George Bush Sr., an oil man, did not take out Saddam Hussein, right? Because he was representing the oil interests. And he said, well, it's crazy. If I invade Iraq, we'll create instability, civil war, carnage and mayhem, which will jeopardize oil interests because oil companies want stability in the Middle East. The American empire is exactly that. It's an empire. It can influence countries through market imperialism. In fact, at the Vancouver hearings, we had Susan Lindauer testify, who testified that in the 1990s, Saddam Hussein was begging her as the liaison officer between the CIA and the Iraqi government to become the US's stooge again, because he knew the alternative was to be lynched. And so there's many who would argue that the US didn't really have to do a kind of 9/11 incident against itself, because it was already in power. The traditional US foreign policy establishment already had power, already had hegemony in the Middle East. Moreover, people like Saddam Hussein were begging to be the US's stooge again. Saddam Hussein said he'd buy 1 million cars a year, he'd let them despoil all his oil resources and so on. But he obviously wasn't stupid, he knew what the alternative was. And so when we get into the nuances of the geopolitics of 9/11, it becomes quite clear that it had a lot to do with Israel, and therefore you have to ask yourself who really was in such a predicament that they had to go to such extremes to do something like 9/11. And I would argue that the evidence suggests that it had a lot more to do with Israel than with the traditional U.S. foreign policy establishment.
But it sounds like from what you're saying, Joshua, is you're not actually saying that it was just Israel acting alone as a sovereign nation state, because of course the US and Israel are very closely interconnected. So there are all kinds of pressure groups within US politics and government at different levels that are representing the interests of Israel. So it, in a sense, it sort of blurs the distinction. And when we're talking about covert military type operations, they're done in a deniable way. So basically whoever's doing them in total secrecy anyway. And so, I mean, I do agree that there is strong evidence that Israel was involved in some way, mainly because of those five agents that were found photographing and backslapping each other as the towers were burning. But beyond that, I don't really know. And it sounds like what you're saying is it's more a web of influence and interconnection rather than you're saying, you know, Israel as a nation state did it.
Yeah, well, I mean, nation states are themselves kind of manifestations of factions of the ruling class. I gather Israel has more billionaires per capita than any other country in the world. You look at the Forbes rich list, sort of half of the richest people in the United States happen to be of Jewish ethnicity. And so Israel, Professor Petrus says, you know, there's a Zionist power configuration that kind of transcends the U.S. and Israel. And that represents a kind of locus of power. And I believe that locus of power kind of...
just keep going, Joshua. We've got about 1 minute left.
You know, they're first and foremost oriented towards Israel, in my opinion.
Yeah, first and foremost oriented towards Israel, correct. Now, just a quick opinion on some of the earlier things you were saying. I think that that a political approach as well as an evidence-based approach is necessary, but I totally applaud people like Richard Gage for sticking to what they're good at. And I believe those who are good at evidence-based approaches should continue to do that, but then there would need to be a political approach as well. And I'm not sure whether expanding the boundaries of research is the correct way of doing that, but we have run out of time. Thank you so much for coming on today. Sorry, we'll be back next week. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Thanks, Joshua. I think we may have lost the connection there. Good night.